One of the boys was a show. What do you get when you bring together Dana Carvey in his first starring role, Nathan Lane in his first starring role, music and acting icon Scatman Crothers, and cap it off with the vaudeville stylings of Hollywood legend Mickey Rooney? Turns out not a lot. This 1982 sitcom is about an energetic senior who ditches the nursing home, where he inexplicably lives because he's in terrific shape, to move in with his college student grandson and roommate. This show even features appearances from the likes of Olympia Dukakis and Meg Ryan in her second role ever. Bryn, Aaron, Barry, and special guest co-host Neil Fisher of the podcast Triviality try to figure out why this show got pulled off stage by that giant cane. Cold open. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince. But those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production. I don't know. We were talking about energy drinks the other day, and what was it? Balls? It was called like balls?
Balls. Balls if you were, balls if like I had money.
Yeah, B-A-W-L-S.
Balls was a gamer one, but yeah. I was never much of a gamer, but it was also expensive.
But it was in that fancy blue bottle, so yeah. It felt a little more
special. I liked NOS.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one I liked. It came in the giant NOS container.
That was like the peak era of the energy drink was the early 2000s. Like that was
NOS, Monster, Red Bull. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
And people would be like, that's so bad for you. Why do you drink that?
Because we don't like ourselves and
yeah,
we want.
Because I have a death wish, man.
Yeah, I was going to say energy drinks strike me as being particularly nihilistic. And like if you say to someone they're not good for you, the person will be like, uh-huh.
Exactly.
And?
Yeah. That was like our peak like edgelord like.
You know, but back then like it's like people used to be like, it's not good for you all that caffeine. If somebody had just been like, "Is you know, the caffeine's not great, but you know what's really not great? Like, it's got like 10 times the amount of sugar you're supposed to have in a
right.
day.
Yeah, that might have poison.
That might have gotten me. Anyways.
Well, plus, we have that and like bags of like gummy worms and crap. And
so does this count as part of our preamble?
Sort of. Sorry, Neil. This is what we do every time, too.
Honestly, you should just cut in like just mid-conversation about energy drinks.
No, zero context.
Oh, yeah. So we're doing a thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's a sign that we're really comfortable with you is that we're just doing our full-on bullshit. Anyway.
Thank you. No, okay. It's so funny thinking of the energy drinks about you have all that sugar and the caffeine, and it's like, well, we gave you taurine and ginkgo biloba, so it's healthy.
So true.
Yeah.
Welcome to another exciting episode of That Was a Show. I really thought you guys would have just jumped in and been like, hey, how's it going? You
know? Hey.
Jesus.
How's it going?
It's too late. It's too late.
Yeah.
It's too late. Who cares how it's going? Well, we've got a special guest this week. I'm excited to talk with somebody again because, you know, I like when we do the guests.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of fun.
It's amazing. So we're super thrilled to have Neil Fisher here joining us. He's a filmmaker and author of a new book coming out this April, Being Patrick Swayze, The Essential Teachings from the Master of the Mullet. Welcome to That Was a Show, Neil.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of your show, and it was just a wonderful email to get to be invited to to be on this show. So thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'd love to give a big shout out to friend of the pod, Sean Bernstein, for connecting us with Neil last year. Sean is a very loyal listener and a friend, and it's just so important for podcasts to connect and Aaron and I were on Triviality, Neil's very popular podcast last year.
Prolific podcast.
We had kind of a poor showing. I think we were entertaining, but we didn't quite nail the trivia part of it.
But we picked up a lot of Triviality listeners for our show afterwards. So probably a few of you are listening to this episode and you'll recognize us from that.
Yeah.
That's what counts. We did get emails that people loved you and thought you were great. So, I mean, that's what you really want anyway. Who cares about winning a trivia game?
Well, that's nice to hear.
And I don't remember how this all came about because there was a lot of emails back and forth and I'm a big skimmer. How do we come up with this week's episode? How do we get to one of the boys? I know Neil selected it. This was delightful. This was a true piece of like, it just feels like a little bit of a, like, I don't know, like a little time capsule or yep. a little bit of like a little hidden gem, not necessarily in a quality way, but like the fact that this show exists is something that I had no prior knowledge of. And until quite frankly, this morning, didn't know the breadth of talent involved in this. And every second I was just like, oh my God, really?
Yeah.
Really?
You? Yeah. So, okay. So this has been on our list for a while. Like, I think it has been on the running list of shows.
I don't look at our
but
list.
But it's also
yeah.
such a big list now that it's easy to forget what's on there.
I mean, and we've said this before, like, we will never run out of material for this podcast because the 80s and 90s were just like full of these short-lived sitcoms. So this has been on the list for a long time. And you know, we kind of went back and forth with Neil to like pick like the best one, and I think we all just agreed like this would be a really fun one to talk about. Neil, why don't you give us a little
a little rundown?
Yeah.
Sure, I'll give you a rundown. Yeah, I thought it'd be a fun one to choose, and I'll say why here in a second. But I'm just happy to talk about this show. As Barry said, it's like a time capsule with so many stars, and it just seems, you know, not real. But when you watch it, it's definitely real.
Well, it felt like a fever dream.
Yeah, right. It does feel like a fever dream. You're right. It's like they found a set. They're like, hey, let's put these actors in here, and it's like Survivor. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, it kind of feels like that.
So basically, if you tuned in to hear a discussion about the 1985 teen comedy Just One of the Guys, or One of the Boys, the second studio album of Katy Perry featuring I Kissed a Girl, then you've got the wrong podcast. But please stick around because Bryn, Aaron, and Barry are wonderful hosts, and this program is just a delight, as I said before. So I'm happy to be here to talk about a show that is ranked number 24 on TV Guide's 50 Worst Shows of All Time, despite boasting a cast list of recurring characters and day players that should certainly have won some sort of casting award. And I'm talking about One of the Boys. One of the Boys is an American sitcom that aired on NBC and premiered on January 23rd, 1982, running for a total of 13 episodes before bowing out of TV history forever a mere 3 months later in April of 1982. The series follows two college roommates, Adam and Jonathan, who just want to study, pass their classes, and date co-eds at Sheffield College in New Jersey. Putting a wrench in their plans is Adam's spry grandfather, Oliver Nugent, who escapes his boring nursing home to come live with the undergrads, inserting himself and his friend Bernard into their lives. As with all 80s sitcoms, hijinks, some funny, and some definitely not, ensue. One of the Boys was created by Saul Turtletaub and Bernie Orenstein, veteran TV writers of The Carol Burnett Show, That Girl, Sanford and Son, and What's Happening, amongst other series. The writing duo are actually credited with giving first jobs to the likes of Richard Pryor, Gary Shandling, George Clooney, Meg Ryan, and two stars of the show. The prolific duo was often congratulated for having done 23 sitcoms in a 50-year career, to which Turtletaub would reply, "You might be impressed I've made 23 TV shows, but every producer will tell you that making 23 shows only means that you've had 23 shows canceled." One of the Boys stars master impressionist and SNL all-timer Dana Carvey as Adam Shields in his first TV role, as his comedic sparring partner, star of stage and screen, both big and small, also in his first TV role, Nathan Lane, playing Carvey's roommate and best friend, Jonathan Burns. Rounding out the cast are Hollywood legend and seemingly endless ball of kinetic energy, Mickey Rooney, as Adam's grandfather, Oliver Nugent. And rounding out the cast are Francine Beers as Mrs. Green, landlord and possible love interest, maybe. And last but not least, beloved American actor and musician, an unfortunate film casualty at the Overlook Hotel, Scatman Crothers. I chose this show today thanks to an interview with Dana Carvey and David Letterman when he talked about this show and the craziness of working with Mickey Rooney. But once I saw that its short 13-episode run featured appearances from none other than Meg Ryan, Wendy Malick, Estelle Getty, Cleavon Little, Barney Miller, and Olympia Dukakis, amongst other I Know That Face performers, and had an unnecessary animated intro and end of episode stinger shot in a long shot with completely ADR tags and one-off jokes that I'm sure were workshopped to death, I had to choose it. So, can this short-lived television show starring some of the most talented people in Hollywood history be that bad? That's why I'm here and you're the expert, so let's find out.
That was one hell of an intro.
Yeah, that was incredible. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Well, you told me to prepare. I wanted to show up for you guys because I appreciate what you do.
Incredible.
I want to hang up the headphones after that one, man. That was
that was great.
Yeah, so like where to begin on this? Like I feel like it's like chock full of tropes.
Okay. I'll tell you where I want to begin.
Okay.
Which is, you know, you've mentioned, Neil, the stacked cast. And everyone in this either was at the tail end of a career of hundreds of iconic roles or at the beginning of a career of hundreds of iconic roles. And I think one way to look at this show is really through the actors and the various characters that sort. Well, characters is maybe too strong of a word. The people with faces that they portrayed on a soundstage to create this show. For me, in my notes, Dana Carvey was the starting place because the show in the pilot, in many ways, begins with a showcase of Dana Carvey's vocal impressions, which, of course, like, I know that he's known for that. But at the time when this show was made, he wasn't known for that.
Yeah.
Yet.
No, but it was part of his stand-up, right? So that's how he got the damn job, right?
Yeah.
Him being, that would have been part of his stand-up.
Right.
So clearly they were like, well, we want to make sure that we get the kid doing the thing that he does.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, like mass TV audiences might have not known that yet. So in some ways, this was like him.
Yeah, it's a showcase.
This was a showcase for this.
Yeah. And for his bowl cut. His like,
and for that one, that
one bowl cut,
his David Cassidy haircut,
and for the one sweater that he wears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh my god,
I love that too. That was the first note I wrote down. Was I love that within the first few minutes we get impressions from Dana Carvey and then Nathan Lane sort of stealing the spotlight like he's on stage right away.
Yeah, I wrote like, okay, there's Nathan Lane being on Broadway, but in a sitcom, but on Broadway.
yeah. I mean, it's so bizarre seeing those two so young, but doing the exact shtick that they're known for to this day. Like it's just. It's very odd. It was almost like when we watched It's Your Move with Jason Bateman as a teen doing the exact same shtick. It's like, it's such a weird, it's like, oh, it's just like a very, like a younger face and a younger body, but they're literally doing the exact same thing. Like it's very interesting and jarring.
I found it a little fun and weird that like, we get that right off the bat from Dana Carvey, but then he kind of, mostly only in the pilot, settles into a straight man role and like is basically the one that people are bouncing against.
Yep.
And I was just like, I don't think I've ever seen him play that. Ever.
Yeah.
Like I've never seen Dana Carvey regular man before.
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, I don't know if I care for it. I will say this about this show. As much as it's not, the pilot's a little rough. Pilot's pretty rough. Like it was very cheaply produced, which is not normal for some of these like big network shows. Some weird audio setups in like their like location shooting, like in the first episode. But also, I didn't hate it. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's even particularly good, but I sure didn't mind watching it.
I felt the same way. I usually feel like Barry in a lot of these episodes where, you know, he doesn't want to say it's really bad or it's really good, but I watching it, I'm like, that's a weird setup to have Mickey Rooney's entrance, him with his back turned and like, it looked like a student film for some reason.
It did.
Okay.
All the shots of like, I was like, why did you take your like video camera to shoot like all this footage of him driving to the nursing home?
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned that. So that exterior nursing home scene where they introduce him, I wrote, okay, that basically it felt odd for a sitcom. And I'm going to say something that might be controversial here. I actually kind of liked that scene, but for the wrong reasons. So I liked that it actually felt so naturalistic, as if they were just trying to figure out what to say as they were going along. Like, it felt like, in some ways, a natural, like, fly on the wall, documentary video camera capturing a real moment between a grandfather and a grandson. Granted, a grandfather who's someone who is always on and likes to do shtick.
Is Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
Someone of his ilk. But it felt naturalistic in a way that was like 2 decades ahead of its time, but made no sense for the rest of the show and did not feel appropriate for the sitcom or the premise. But like, just as a scene, was interesting.
Yeah.
It reminded me so much of like just the awkward pacing and blocking of like the first like failed feature film I made, like 15 years ago. I was just like, just a video camera and a couple of people buttering their way through some dialogue. No Mickey Rooney in mind. He was not available, but
I was in it. You know, that was my only acting role ever.
That's true.
Did you escape a nursing home?
No, I didn't.
No.
I was a teen mother and or not a teen mother, a young mother.
You were a young mother,
Who named her daughter Pink after the singer.
That's right.
Oh.
That's right.
Yeah. It was incredible. So Neil, why don't we get into the episodes that we watched? So to prepare for this podcast, we watched the pilot and we also watched a two-parter, which were the two final like episodes of this series. So why don't you take us through the pilot, Neil?
Yep, I'll give you a little short description. So we're covering the pilot, as you said, and it's actually known as the Lost Pilot, and it actually ran last in the series run, at least according to Wikipedia. It was the last episode ever to air in April of 1982, even though it was technically the first one. But I suppose with a show like this, you don't really need that much backstory, knowing that Mickey Rooney is just going to come in and chew scenery for half an hour. The story basically, as I said, follows Adam, played by Dana Carvey. He goes to visit his grandfather, Oliver, played by Mickey Rooney, who lives at a nursing home. And he's just very bored at this nursing home. He doesn't like being there. He considers himself young. And Dana Carvey says, well, why don't you come live with us in our apartment on the college campus? So Dana Carvey brings him back, to the dismay of his roommate, Jonathan, who's Nathan Lane. And then the two roommates basically watch from afar as Oliver charms the likes of Winnie Malick and Meg Ryan with songs on the piano, jokes, and scrapbook stories about only the most romantic of subjects, like Pearl Harbor.
Another good description.
One of my favorite, like, just out of nowhere lines is him opening up a scrapbook and then going, and now we come to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, did he already have all of his stuff at the apartment? Like, why was that scrapbook, like, one of the things that happened?
In his suitcase with his clothes were clearly, like...
Yep.
Yeah.
It was a heavy suitcase.
Scrapbooks.
Very heavy suitcase.
The 1980s version of, like, your camera roll on your phone. Like,
yeah.
Here's my scrapbook.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I have to say, whenever a script, keeps mentioning a tall woman... I feel like Wendy Malick is like the Chekhov's gun there. I wonder if it's gonna be Wendy Malick.
Wendy Malick. I was delighted. I wasn't expecting her to show up, but
no.
I was very
which
delighted.
Then, of course, leads into the surprise of while you're excited to see Wendy Malick, you're like, is that fucking Meg Ryan?
Yeah,
and it was, and you they're know, delightful.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion of height in that episode, which was like very funny. Like, it was like a recurring theme.
Because he's short.
Surprise. And she was the tall woman. And it was like lots of like, yeah.
They're
like,
all tall to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Aside from the obvious, very 1982 misogyny that you see play out in the whole episode, but especially once the two extremely one-dimensional female characters get brought in for the sake of being the targets of, I don't know who's worse, the young guys who refer to them as things like the tall one and my glands are acting up, or the old guy who's like physically pawing his hands all over them and like trying to charm them at a piano. But I feel like at the time they must have been going for something where he's supposed to be sentimental or charming or something, because they made such a meal out of that scene.
Yeah.
I wrote down, yeah, so Nathan Lane says, I had a long talk with my glands and all systems are ready to go. Which I, first of all, I was like, oh, that's a crazy line. And then Dana Carvey followed it up with, we're going to give them tiger's milk and have a great night. And I was like, what is tiger's milk? And I had to look it up. I mean, it's liquor, but I thought it was like a double entendre or something. I'm like, whoa, that is very, very risque.
I didn't even want to look it up. I was just like, I don't know where he's going with this.
That's just what people said back then. It was a lot of like,
My brain went there too, where I was like, tiger's milk was, no.
Yeah. It was basically one step short of the auga thing from a cartoon.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, at least like as gross as like they all were, at least kind of grandpa stopped the girls from possibly being taken advantage of by these like pervs. So, you know.
True. He did serve that purpose, even if that wasn't his intention.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like what... I don't know how successful it is, but again, yeah, it's 1982. It's a weird time, much like all of these shows. But it just feels like I think the script is supposed to take a bit of a left turn because he's pawing at them, but he's Mickey Rooney, so it's happening. I don't think he's trying to be creepy. Like I think he is just trying to be sweet. And then even at the end, he's like, you know, I haven't really had such a nice time in like 20 years, which makes me sad. Yeah. Because I'm like, he's only 65. And like,
yeah,
he's not even that old. He's like Wilford Brimley. He like looks 30 years older than he really is.
Yeah.
I'm like, since you're,
Yeah.
He's barely old enough to be a grandfather to
he's had a long, sad. Well, you got to remember, I mean, people used to actually be able to retire. So,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it is an important thing to note that while we said that this guy moves out of a nursing home, that's how it's pegged, to live with his grandson. Mickey Rooney was like 61 or 62 at the time that they shot this.
Well,
and he has the physicality of someone that age, too. He looks old.
The character they do say is 65, so he's young.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even catch that.
Oh, yeah,
that
multiple times.
That is so weird. That is so weird. That's like my dad's age.
It is. It's really strange. And then they show you know, the scene of the nursing home, and he's on the putting green, and the grass is like 4 inches long, and they're having trouble putting. Anyway, I just thought it was so funny because Mickey Rooney's like, hey, help me escape. Dana Carvey agrees to it finally, and I was expecting they were going to do like a sitcom thing where like they put him in a wheelchair and then they like there's a chase scene down the hallway, and all of a sudden I was like, okay, what's the zany escape going to be? And then there's a quick cut. He's already in the apartment. They've escaped.
There's not even like a conversation or a back and forth. No. They're just like, let's just keep going.
Escape is basically, I'd like to move out now. Okay, yeah. What do we care? You're paying like, to be here.
It's a retirement community, man. You're probably paying a pretty penny to live there.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, it definitely did seem inconsiderate to bring this new roommate, whether it's his grandfather or not, into that apartment without consulting the Nathan Lane character.
Yeah, it was only a one bedroom apartment. Like it was only like they were the two young guys were not even supposed to be living there together. Like it was just like a one bedroom apartment with a pull out couch. So
yeah, they had a pesky landlord who just kept upping the rate. And so it was going to create problems.
I feel like that's a trope of 80s movies where there's like the landlord who's like always busting people's balls and like, you know, always just saying, you know, oh, like, you know, like they're always trying to kind of hide something from the landlord. Like,
I can't even get my landlord to come fix our door.
Yeah.
And you know, admittedly, like if you were bringing in a new roommate, it would be totally rational that the landlord would have to be notified of this.
I thought she was pretty fair.
Yeah, perfectly fair. And raising someone's rate by a few percent year over year is not that big of a deal. But the part that was weird was that as soon as he just appears, like as soon as she sees him for the first time, she doesn't know that he's living there. She immediately bumps on the fact that they basically, as far as she's concerned, has a visitor. It's like, why would she immediately have alarms going off that they have a visitor?
Yeah.
But apparently she was right to have alarms because their first instinct was to just not even be like, my grandpa's visiting.
I noticed that too. I was like, all you have to do is say, my grandpa's over and we're hanging out and going out to dinner or whatever. And that would have squashed it right away. But they're like lying and hiding. I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, we didn't watch the full series because, you know, frankly, why would we? But like, I found it. You know, I might be just for this question I'm about to pose is like, it seems like from the beginning that the whole premise is going to be grandpa trying to fit into the young people's lives. But by the time we get to the final, like, two-parter, it seems like it's very much the young people fitting into senior citizen life. Like, it seems like they're pulled into the old folks, like, world orbit, instead of the reverse, which is a very odd choice. Like, is it, like, I wonder where that transition happened, or maybe it wasn't a transition, maybe it was going back and forth throughout the series.
Now, but I actually have some interesting thoughts on that, but I want to save this thought until after we discuss those episodes in more detail. But I'm glad that you brought up the fact that the show does seem to, I guess we don't know if it was a sudden pivot or if this was a gradual evolution over the course of 12 episodes.
It's the pivot that makes me say I would watch the show, because basically as you go into the next two episodes, you realize that the show very much just becomes the Mickey Rooney and Scatman Crothers show.
Yeah.
And that's a show I want to watch.
Yeah.
I love the two of them bouncing off of each other. I love everything about Scatman Crothers in general in this.
Same,
so like,
same.
Yeah. So like, I was like kind of like, whatever, in the first episode. And then the next two, when it's just the two of them, oh man, I was so on board for it.
Well, if we're doing this, then maybe we should talk about the plot of that one and get into it. But does anyone have anything else they wanted to add about the pilot before we move on?
I just had two little things I wrote down. One was how excited I was to hear their rent was $280 a month plus utilities, which was amazing for the location that they had and all that good stuff. And then I had a Leonardo DiCaprio Once Upon a Time in Hollywood meme moment where you point at the TV. You see, when I was waiting for it, and Mickey Rooney's like, hey, can I be one of the boys? And I was like, hey, there it is.
He said it.
Okay, I have two little tiny notes about the pilot. One is that the type of joke that I hate that happens so much when it's like a quickly written joke is the line, I had a bruise the size of Portugal. Why Portugal? That's not a useful reference that people can relate to. A bruise the size of, there's an infinite number of ways that you can end that statement that are funnier than picking some random country.
That's the structure of a joke, though. You pick a random thing.
I know,
because it's a funny word.
But pick something.
Cucamonga.
I had a bruise the size of a hamburger. Like,
a
literally Buick. Anything.
It's all in the delivery.
Right.
I had a bruise the size of Portugal.
Yeah,
I had a bruise the size of a grapefruit. You know,
like a Mad Lib joke. It's like insert like place here after.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh, let's just be different. Like everyone's done the size of New York City or the size of whatever.
But when you see sitcoms that are really good at that, like there are some sitcoms that play jokes that are kind of that type of structure.
Yeah.
But somehow they're actually funny because either it is all in the delivery or they're just really good at picking references that the making the reference itself is funny, because just mentioning the thing that is somehow like a weird relatable thing ends up getting a laugh.
I think just one of the writers had recently been to Portugal and wanted to reference it.
For sure. There's the whiteboard in the writer's room. Oh, yeah. It was so funny because a lot of these jokes were just stuff that you've heard before. And as Barry said, I think Scatman and Rooney make them better, because a lot of the jokes, I knew where it was going to go. I knew what the punchline was going to be, and I knew it was going to be bad. But I was like, okay, let's see how they perform it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was entertaining, at least, you know. And speaking of that, though, you know, I saw the little shticks that they started building. Like Nathan Lane just had to keep getting woken up because it was so funny that he was sleeping every time Mickey Rooney came in. But you could just see the threads that they started putting together, and I think having them chew the scenery just made it that much more entertaining, because you knew where it was going to go. Mm-hmm. So
that's true. And the one little thing that I liked, one little detail that I liked, was Mickey Rooney's character. He plops himself down on the couch and sort of inserts himself into the lives of these two roommates. And he turns on the TV and starts watching some late night horror movie. The sound comes on really loud, and he reaches over and in an extremely naturalistic reaction, turns down the volume to a respectable level. And I'm like, that's something I have not seen much in a sitcom. Like turning on a TV, it not being at the volume you want it to be, and then having to change it. It's just one of those things that is so real that I couldn't help but like just be like, oh, that's cool.
Sidebar, why did he start strangling Nathan Lane when as a reaction to the monster? That was so weird.
Because that page just said vamp.
Yeah, and, just do something crazy, I guess.
You could see Mickey Rooney's eyes like when the script said vamp, because there's several moments in these episodes where like he just was dead in the eyes, but he was trying to come up with something. Yeah.
It's true. You got to give him credit for the fact that he probably did do at least some improv in this. And there are moments where there's a long, awkward pause.
Some.
But there's moments where there's like a long pause and then he launches into more shtick where you're just like, this guy just has like a Rolodex in his brain of stuff.
Yeah.
He's just like, all right, I guess I'll pull this out now.
So I know we're trying to get to the two-parter here, but I have one more point to make.
Okay.
I want to draw a connection to another previously reviewed sitcom. This very much reminded me of Davis Rules in that it was meant to be a showcase for an older legendary comic. So
100%.
Yeah. So Davis Rules was meant to be a showcase for Jonathan Winters. And this is now, you know, the Mickey Rooney show. And it's this odd thing of like that we've seen in the 80s and 90s where they're really trying to appeal to the older audience, but yet trying to bring in the younger audience as well. Like they're trying to get one of your old favorites to, you know, get the folks who are middle-aged or older to like really, you know, tune in. So it's like the comedic stylings that are kind of like on their way out of being like funny. Like, and then you're trying to get like the new young blood in. And in this case, they really went for it with Dana Carvey and Nathan Lane. Like they really tried. They're like, okay, we got to get the young folks. We got to get the old folks. And maybe that's why there was like that weird transition, because they were like, oh, okay, none of the young people are watching this.
Well, the difference between the two is that unlike Jonathan Winters, Mickey Rooney is not terrible in this.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know.
Jonathan Winters in that show is unbearable to watch because he doesn't care what other people are doing around him, whereas Mickey Rooney is playing with the other people in the scene, at least.
Yeah, I wonder how many of our listeners have now tuned out because there's this weird hatred for our Davis Rules episode. It's like still our lowest listened to show.
Actually, I think it is no longer the lowest.
Oh, it isn't.
No,
okay.
No,
I gave at least one, so.
Yeah, it caught up maybe because of how much
Big
we
Wave
talked
Dave's?
About it.
Yeah. Is it Big Wave Dave's?
No. Actually, I believe our lowest now is Teddy Z.
Which is weird because that was a fun episode.
Which was
anyway.
One of our most interesting episodes. And we referenced Teddy Z in trying to deconstruct so many other shows. So you must be
lost just listening to our show, guys.
So,
you skipped that one.
Go back and listen to Davis Rules, the original episode and the bonus episode, and listen to Teddy Z. Like,
no, don't do it.
Anyway,
give it a chance.
One of the boys needed Helen Hunt, because I think that's what was missing, is some nice Helen Hunt. And I was just thinking about Davis Rules, like only sitcoms could make Randy Quaid the prototypical patriarch of a family and make it realistic.
Got the wrong Quaid.
Quaid. Yeah, that was our conclusion.
Hashtag wrong Quaid.
Yeah, forever.
Oh, of course.
did you know that Dennis Quaid and Randy Quaid have not spoken in over 20 years because of a botched land deal?
Oh, really?
There you go.
Yeah. It sounds like a dramatic show like Yellowstone, but it's the Quaids against each other. What's that? What were those two families? The famous ones?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, I can't think of their names, but I'm on a trivia show. I have no idea.
I know exactly what you mean. I don't know the names. Yeah.
Hatfields and the McCoys?
There you go.
Yes.
Hatfields and McCoys.
Yeah, could you imagine a reality TV show that's like Keeping Up with the Quaids?
That's gold.
I feel like they wouldn't do it. It would go to some dark places, I think.
Go to? It would begin in.
Very quickly.
Yeah, very quickly.
So, all that being said, Neil, would you like to brief us officially on the two-parter of episodes 12 and 13?
Yes. So 12 and 13 was a two-part. It was the sort of the finale of the series. And it, as you mentioned, there's that shift in tone. And it's very clear because right away in the beginning, I believe it's of the 12th episode, there's just way more senior citizens than young people in the cast. It's stark contrast to the first episode, to the pilot. So the two-parter follows the whole gang, both Dana Carvey and Nathan Lane, Mickey Rooney, Scatman Crothers. Basically, they're going to be putting on a variety show, and everyone's very excited about it because Mickey Rooney invites Dana Carvey and Nathan Lane to be a part of it, and Dana Carvey does some wonderful impressions that are a lot of fun. And Nathan Lane does a great rendition of I Am the Very Model of a Modern Major General from Pirates of Penzance. And basically, yeah, they're putting on this variety show. And before they put on the variety show, they're going to an ATM to get some money from their new performing endeavor.
We're laughing because it's so ridiculous.
It's the most ridiculous ATM I've ever seen built anywhere.
Yes.
Or rendered on screen. It's like out of Total Recall or something.
Don't forget that this show is so old that there is a scene that describes to the audience what a bank card is.
I was gonna write that down because it's like six lines of them like, what is it? Oh, you put a code in. Okay. And the ATM, it's so funny, and I'll get to the rest of the plot here, because the first time Mickey Rooney uses it, very easily puts in his secret code. The second time he uses it, he just decided, I'm just going to type 20 different keys, even though it's a six-letter word that I'm putting in here, so he definitely had that choice. So yeah, they're at the ATM, and there are robbers watching the ATM. Mickey Rooney gets mugged and gets kind of beat up. They hire a police officer to teach him and the rest of the new seniors that now are in this universe that we didn't know from the pilot, teaches them some self-defense. A love interest is born, sort of, between Mickey Rooney and Francine Beers, Mrs. Green. And then before their variety show, the ATM starts spitting out tons of money. In fact, $25,000 of money that they hide on the run from Seinfeld's Barney Miller and Blazing Saddles Cleavon Little, who are trying to rob them during the variety show. So that's sort of the final two-parter there.
Yeah, so good description.
It's an
epic journey.
It was it felt like two different shows. Like, it felt like two different episodes, like the whole robbery plot and the variety show plot. Like, it was so weird, and it was like, they had these two ideas that they really had to like weave together somehow. And so, of course, they make like one of the robbers actually be like the nightclub, or like, is it a nightclub or was it at the retirement home?
It's a retirement home.
No. They're at the nightclub.
It's confusing.
They're at the They're at the nightclub who is graciously allowing them to put on a variety show for Bayview Acres.
Yeah.
But no, they're not involved in it. They just follow them to the club.
Mm. Yeah, but didn't, what's his name say? No, he's like, you've got a few minutes before your show.
He's just, they followed them.
Yeah.
They followed them.
He put that on.
Yeah, Barney Miller, I think, was just saying it so he'd get them out of the room.
Right.
Okay, I didn't pick up on
that. That's his scam.
See, the problem was I had a hard time paying attention because I was just like, I can't with this. This is too stupid.
Man, I was so much fun
I do
want
to say, I found the plot of this to be stupid, but to Barry's point, and I know I was saving this, but I can't hold it back. I did find Mickey Rooney and Scatman Crothers charming. And it struck me that if you built a show that was just around them, get rid of all the rest of this apparatus. Yeah. Get rid of the grandson, the college students, the moving into the apartment, and lean into the variety show that they do. So if it's just them, they're living in a retirement home, they're doing variety shows for other seniors, and they're having trouble kind of navigating things in the modern world that are not super accommodating to older people, like an ATM, which in 1982 was, probably pretty new.
Space-aged.
But like, that makes sense as a show, and they're both talented in that realm. Like, you put them on stage doing that kind of vaudevillian variety show thing, they're actually very good at that.
they're so much better at the like fussy odd couple back and forth than Dana Carvey and Nathan Lane are with each other.
Exactly.
Well, it's like Scatman Crothers wasn't even in the pilot.
Right.
No, no. Because the pilot, they shot the pilot and then the show went to series. Yeah. And like Neil said, I guess they didn't even air it till after it ended. So like clearly they were happy with elements of the pilot, but just they were like, we need more Scatman Crothers.
But Scatman Crothers is the most compelling part of the show. The first scene, this is a good example of one of those things where the joke is kind of predictably structured. The interaction over, they get the check from their gig and who's going to take the check. And it's a very predictable interaction.
I feel like that joke went on way too long, though, for sure. The scene in the bank where they're arguing over the design of the check, it went on way too long.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
I was checking out throughout that, no pun intended. It went on way too long. I was like,
But that's an editing thing. That could have been cut down and it would have been good.
I just felt like it was too indulgent. And that's what I like get annoyed over. Like, it's like, I get that, it is more entertaining to see the two of them interact and riff off of each other. But as far as like the structure of like an episode, I can't. Like, I just can't, like, I don't like that when they just like let people indulge and like, you know, it's just like overrun with shtick. Well, like, it's really annoying. Yes. So, and that's what happened with Davis Rules and other shows like that, where it's like they just take an.
You're just describing Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, well.
That's the whole series.
But no, they don't. They're still like a very well-structured episode.
They know when to cut out of a joke. So it's. Yes, what you're getting at is
we're also 40 years in the format later.
Yeah, but my biggest problem with this show is it actually feels like it's less than the sum of its parts instead of more than the sum of its parts.
Absolutely.
It's a whole bunch of talented people who are each just showcasing what they are capable of, and it just ping-pongs between, let's get a few minutes of this person. Mm-hmm. So what they do on stage during that variety show where one person goes up to the mic, does their thing, thanks the audience, and then welcomes up the next person. That's what the whole sitcom is. Whether it's Dana Carvey or Nathan Lane or any of them, it's all just point the camera at this person. They do their shtick. Ta-da-da-da-da. Take a bow for the audience. Get some applause. And now let's pass it over to this person. There's no cohesive purpose for it. It's just...
There's no connective tissue.
None whatsoever. I wrote that down under my episode 13 or part two was I just put the entire episode is just a resume builder. Everyone said, what are you good at? What do you want people to know you for? Do it. And then hopefully you'll get another job after this. It really was.
Yeah, it felt like a variety show. Yeah, like the whole thing felt like it was like, okay, so-and-so is going to do this thing. So-and-so's going to do this thing. And it was like, I had to look up who exactly Mickey Rooney was portraying, like when he was doing his impersonations. I was like, who the hell is this like character he's playing? And it was like the Great Schnozzola, which I guess is like a legendary vaudeville star.
Jimmy Durante.
Yeah, Jim. Yeah. And I was like,
there's a lot of past due checks to his estate.
Yeah. But it's like in a 1982 sitcom, that's where you go. Like, were people who would know that reference really watching this sitcom? Like,
I wrote the same thing down because I said he's referencing Jimmy Durante. So 2022, if this was a show, and let's just say what I think would work is put Nathan Lane in the role and have Dana Carvey and him now do it together as old people. But anyway, what would the equivalent be if Nathan Lane was on stage and was referencing an old comic, do you think, in 2022? Like, what would it be, like a 19, like Lenny Bruce or something, or like George Carlin? I don't know.
I feel like people know who they are, like a contemporary, well, maybe not. Maybe not like Gen Z.
Well, they might have, in theory.
It would be someone of Carlin's era.
They might have then, too.
Yeah.
Right?
Someone of Carlin's era, but not Carlin. Someone one or two notches less well-known.
Yeah.
But that's probably the zone.
That was a show.
We'll be right back after these messages.
Hey, honey, why haven't you eaten your toast?
I don't know. I guess I'm just sick of this regular, boring peanut butter.
Well, maybe it's time we make our meals an adventure.
Whoa, what's this? Wonder Nut Butter?
Try it.
Wow, it's good. It's spiced, but not spicy.
You're such a witty and precocious child.
Spread the world with Wonder Nut Butter's internationally inspired flavors. It's made with only peanuts, spices, and salt, and no added sugar. Try every flavor of Wonder Nut Butters today.
I don't know. That kid sounded a little old.
Really? I thought it was pretty good casting.
That commercial failed to mention that Wonder is based right here in Toronto, Canada.
Or that you can eat Wonder Nut Butters as a healthy snack, like, you know, adding it to a smoothie.
Also, there are three flavors available, inspired by spices from India, Morocco, or Thailand.
I really liked the Moroccan peanut butter on toast with apricot or peach jam.
I've tried Wonder. It's delicious. It looked so enticing. These ads really work.
You can even cook with it, like if you're making a soup or a sauce.
We've been talking a really long time about this commercial.
Yeah, wait, is this meta? Are we part of a commercial? Is Wonder a sponsor if that was a show?
All I know is that our listeners can get a 15% discount when they order Wonder Nut Butters online at tastewonder.com/twas. That's taste, WANDER.com/TWAS and use the coupon code TWAS15 at checkout. And you can follow them at taste.wander on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok.
What are you reading from? Where is that? You didn't answer any of my questions. Can we say the least surprising thing to learn in the world was that Nathan Lane is a Gilbert and Sullivan man? Because I was just like, yeah, this just tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
It was great. I loved hearing him sing that song.
Spectacular.
I mean, he stuck the landing on that bit.
I also
really
like that he did some aside steering it, which I haven't seen anybody do during it. So that was nice.
The two genuine almost laughs that I got out of this were one of them from Scatman Crothers. I apologize for not remembering the character's name.
Bernard.
Okay. But I'm giving the credit to the actor anyway.
Bernard Solomon. I can't believe I remember that.
Yeah. So when they're having that dispute over the check and he says, the check's already in my pocket and you'd have to take it out while I'm moving and that's trouble. So goodbye. And that was a good way to close that exchange, if only they had gotten to that a little quicker. And the self-defense instructor, Rooney's instinct is to actually choke him. And it was like a Homer Simpson choking Bart throttling that he does. And it was actually like it caught me off guard. And that was kind of funny. I laughed at
Man,
that.
Man, Mickey Rooney throwing that beefcake was just amazing.
Yeah,
what a piece of physical comedy.
Do we think that this was the first instance of a self-defense class in an 80s or 90s sitcom?
Oh, good point.
Because we established in a previous episode that that was a trope as
Massive trope.
This might be the first instance.
That's a good question.
It already feels tired.
Yeah, it already feels like, ugh.
It does. It was funny, too, because Mrs. Green had a weird outfit on. It was like a dress with tights for her workout, which I was...
yeah,
but then
that
I
was
guess
like
she
her
was,
sexy outfit.
I was going to say, yeah, her sexy outfit to get Mickey Rooney. But I wrote down, I had a laugh out loud moment, which wasn't intended, but the self-defense instructor comes in, and his first line is, all right, there's a lot of hoodlums out there. I was like, hoodlums?
Hoodlums.
Who says that? I had to write it down.
He said it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The biggest laugh that the audience gives, I have never seen this in a sitcom before, but this laugh carries on for like a straight 45 seconds throughout the scene, and it's Scatman Crothers is walking, like they're welcoming all the senior citizens in are coming.
Oh, I know.
And like the one girl is like, oh, you're really gonna need it. And like it's an offside, like just random thing that he says, and like the audience will not stop laughing, and it went on so long that I couldn't stop laughing because I didn't laugh at the initial line, but I was like, it's just, oh man.
Yeah. So one thing that I kind of chuckled at, like legitimately, was at the end, like it was like such a weird, like the structure of the two-part episode was like ridiculous
so
because it was like
so
it ended like in the middle of like, it was like a legitimate like ending, like on a cliffhanger, because they were at the ATM machine and, you know, Mickey Rooney makes the joke, oh, is there an easier way to make money now? And then that's when they're held up by
except
the
they're
robbers.
Not.
Yeah. But Scatman Crothers remarks, well, I guess there is. And then they both put up their hands and it's like the most like awkward thing ever. Yeah. Like the timing of it was so.
Yeah. But then the scene doesn't even pick up there.
Yeah, I know. It's really
bad. They don't show up. They follow them. Yeah. So it's so weird.
Now, speaking of Bryn, you mentioned the trope of self-defense classes. It feels like in the 80s and into the early 90s, the mugging slash robbery, home invasion, break and enter situations, anything around property crime seemed to be a big trope in sitcoms. I want to throw it to Neil as our resident American co-host. Was this paranoia around like muggings and break-ins a thing at that time? Or is that sitcom land?
That's a good question. It's in a lot of sitcoms, like you said, but, you know, anytime I was young, I mean, every time you go out, you know, into a big city, it's like, well, if you can, keep your wallet in your front pocket and don't let anyone bump you because everyone's, you know, the artful dodger and is going to pickpocket you. So I guess the robbery and the mugging is always kind of in the back of everyone's heads, but I think more in sitcom land, though, for sure.
Yeah,
that's what I thought. Like, it was hard for me to believe that your average person was like as focused on the risk of those things day to day as is portrayed on TV, even at that time. But like so many sitcoms have had plots around that. Very strange. Like,
well, it's just such a hilarious life event, you know, with the personal violence and the PTSD.
It is. But this came up when we were talking about
how funny
our episode. What was the one? Hi, Honey, I'm Home.
This came up in our episode.
Hi, Honey, I'm Home. Yeah. And in that show, it seemed to be satirizing this, but it felt like, was that like propaganda for tough on crime politics?
Well, this was like peak Reagan era.
Yeah, to make people through television feel more worried about these things so that you could then justify, like, let's get more cops out on the beat to protect you against the cartoon muggers that are lurking around every corner.
These were definitely cartoons, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really appreciated Cleavon Little, like, taking a nothing role.
Yeah.
And just having, like, just making a character out of it.
Yeah.
Like, delighting in every line delivery I've never seen such a nothing role just sort of like kind of explode off of the page because of his performance.
Yeah, he stole those scenes.
His gum chewing was always on point. I loved Barney Miller. His name was Big Julie, which I thought was great.
Morty Seinfeld, for anyone who doesn't
Morty
know.
Morty Seinfeld. And actually, I looked it up. I always do this in movies now, which is so funny because I watch a lot of old movies as well. But the $25,000 that came out of the ATM in 2022 would be about $70,000. So it's a lot of change there.
It is a lot of money. Yeah, I found it like, I don't understand. Like, was the implication that, ATM machines were so new that they were just going to malfunction like that and, like, spray money everywhere?
I think that's what I sort of picked up on. Like, I think it was like a, like, man, these newfangled bank machines, like, it's like salt turtle tubs. Like, these things are just going to be nothing but trouble. Let's get ahead of it. Let's get ahead of this one.
I felt really annoyed that the entire cast gradually comes up during that whole thing.
I was just going to say that.
I was everyone's just there ready to, like, throw the money around. Like, it was like, oh, and here's Mrs. Green. Oh, and here are the boys. Oh, it was just like,
Happened to be walking by.
Right.
No, they were all in the same car. They were going to on their way to the thing together.
All huddled around. Yeah, the ATM is so funny.
I love Neil that you mentioned the appearance of the ATM. It cannot be under exaggerated that this thing looked like it came from a props department that had never researched what an ATM looks like. It was not to human scale.
Yeah, no, not at all. Like, you had to reach so high up. And obviously, like, Mickey, the joke was Mickey Rooney was short, but you had to, like, reach up really high to even grab the money. Like, that would not, even back then, that would not have been the case.
I think this was based on some drawings from H.R. Geiger. Like, I think these are, like, right off of, like, the alien-like ship from...
Oh, for sure. Yeah, the computer had, like, the red font, kind of like HAL 9000. Yeah. It had a full keyboard.
Did anybody else love that, like, they clearly... Even the people making this had been like, well, I've never seen one of these things. And, like, like, to make a withdrawal, you had to type the word withdrawal. Yeah.
And it looked like it was spray painted cardboard. Like,
yeah, it looked like a Halloween store level prop.
There's like a, what do you call that? Like an like an eavesdrop, like just like pours the money out through like a giant like fan.
Yeah. Well, yeah, clearly, they had to do it that way. So they got the effect that money was just falling from, you know, high up and shooting at them. And
just imagining the gruff, you know, art department assistant who's there and just like, all right, here's more money. I'm putting the money down for Mickey. Like, just pushing it down.
We good yet? No,
the money that looked very fake.
Mickey wants to do another couple of minutes in this money. We running out of money.
Yeah, he was loving the physical comedy of smelling the money, rubbing it on his face.
He even broke the fourth wall on accident. He stared right into the camera during one of his crazed moments. And I think he tried to play it off like he didn't mean to do it. So he just like waited, then he turned somewhere else. But speaking of Seinfeld, I loved salami as his bank code, because when she said, what do you want your bank code to be? Immediately I said Bosco.
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 Nice.
Because I guess they were just words then?
Yeah.
Have they? So, okay. Again, maybe this is an American-Canadian thing. In your lifetime, has your bank thing ever been a word?
Never, never. Okay.
Mine has.
Oh, it has? Really? I've never had. The only thing I've ever had is when you call the bank, if they need the extra security, they'll say, like, what's your passphrase? But
no,
never for, like, an ATM.
Yeah, it's been, because, like, there are four-letter words.
Wow, yeah, I've never had that.
But it's still numbers on the pad, though.
I know, and I have problems with that sometimes.
Oh, but like
you don't want to just memorize the number?
No, but okay, but yours is my, that's not the thing. Yours is still numbers. You've just come up with a an alphanumeric.
No, it started with a word. And I have to change it, because like the new pin pads
poop.
Are like only numbers now. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
Wow.
Just to pivot.
Wow, okay.
Just to pivot briefly back to the show at hand. one last thing I want to add about their little variety show that they put on for the seniors there. So they did some crowd work at one point, and
oh yes,
Dana Carvey in particular, and it was like it didn't work for me per se, but it was like amusing that they chose to go there. It definitely felt real in a way, but it was very odd. And it's also worth noting that most of that interaction was with one particular gentleman in the audience who starts heckling him. But also that guy's presumably spouse was played with, I had to look this up to confirm, Estelle Getty, who they gave only one, like a one line to, or not even a line, like one or two words. It's like, that's the most underutilized person in this show, because she could have been scintillating.
Wow. That was...
Didn't like women in this show.
great Jimmy Stewart impression by Dana Carvey.
Yeah,
there.
Very good.
And I don't know if I've ever seen that gag before in anything where like somebody does an impression and says, here's Jimmy Stewart, and the person goes, where?
Oh, that's
like, I didn't like it. I'd never seen it before.
I'd never seen it exactly in that execution, but that the style of humor coming out of his interactions with those people in the audience was very like Borscht Belt humor. And this was not like a great execution of it, but for the right audience, who again, like kind of speaking to the way the show seems to have pivoted toward the older audience and away from the younger characters, people of a generation or two older than us might have found that to be absolutely hysterical.
Yeah.
For those of you at home playing the Twas drinking game, Aaron did just mention the Borscht Belt.
Yeah.
So you should you should take the shot now.
Yeah.
I loved all the impressions because I made a note. He did Mr. Rogers, he did Jimmy Stewart. He did Ed Sullivan and Howard Cosell. So just in two episodes alone, you're getting four impressions.
Bob Dylan, right?
Bob Dylan.
Hey, you know, I was upset because in one of the previews for, like, so they had this little thing where it was like next week on, you know, one of the boys, they teased a Neil Young impression that didn't happen.
Oh,
that's true.
Oh, damn.
And it sounded really good and I really wanted to see it, but it didn't actually happen in the episode. Cut for time, I guess.
It's so funny he did Jimmy Stewart, too, because when I was in high school, we did, plays and stuff I was in, but we did one year, it was a sort of a variety show, kind of SNL-esque show with improv and whatnot, and everyone had to say what their impressions they could do were, and I did a bunch of them for the show, but my Jimmy Stewart for the show, I based off of Dana Carvey's, which I didn't even know he was doing it in early 80s, which is really funny, so...
Jimmy's always been a long one that I do, and I've always done it based off of Carvey's and then also the Simpsons Jimmy Stewart as well.
Even I love Jim Carrey's like very old Jimmy Stewart as well, where he's like minutes from death, which is great. I just want to mention one thing. There's so many throwaway jokes in here, and as Aaron said, like, you know, Estelle Getty, like a throwaway cameo, but I don't know if anyone caught this, but I'm a huge Spielberg fan, and just out of nowhere, Nathan Lane referenced to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and then they don't talk about it, and it just goes away.
I didn't catch that.
I love that so much, and the fact that it's a throwaway line, but they also had the props department do up the little, like, mashed potato volcano, like, oh my god, come on.
Yeah.
How did he not notice all that cash stuffed into his pockets? That made no sense as the final ending. And also, like, I noticed in the background during those scenes with the show for the seniors. First of all, I think a lot of the people in the audience were, I mean, whether they were professional background performers or just people they got to be an audience for Mickey Rooney and these other people putting on a show, they might have just been like people out to see this show because they seem to genuinely enjoy it. But I noticed the piano player at the back of the stage was like enamored with getting to see Mickey Rooney and Scatman Crothers do their stuff and do their performances. And I feel like this was like a session musician who probably grew up watching these people and he got cast in this and was like, I fucking love this. Like it didn't seem like he was in the scene or in the moment or someone who had ever performed with these people before. He was just like, cool. This is cool. Like on camera, like, wow, is anyone else seeing this? This is cool.
Just sidebar, I can't decide whether it was cute or annoying that Scatman Crothers character Bernard wrote a song specifically about the retirement home. Like I do have to say that
performance song aside, oh, what a lovely,
but I found it annoying.
He has such a great voice, and oh man, was I just glad that we got like an actual like Scatman Crothers sings. Oh,
for
so
sure.
Nice.
The song in terms of the lyrics, that was cheesy as hell. But his performance, and then we also got a little bit like the tail end of him singing an actual standard, like a good song, and that was even more impressive.
What a treat.
Yeah, that was a treat. And it made me wonder, though, like the opening theme music of this show is real cheeseball.
Oh,
and I'm not saying
Gramps, let's go!
Yeah. Now, if they had taken that song about the seniors and the nursing home and everything that Scatman Crothers performed and made that the theme song, it still would have been cheesy, but at least it would have been on point.
Yeah, but they didn't know what show they were making. No. So it was just like, it was like a show that was evolving as the weeks went on, I guess. Like it
was because Scatman's not even in the animated opening. So you knew that they didn't even have plans for him yet.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Well, wait, wasn't he though? I thought he was.
I don't think, I'm trying to, or maybe not from the nursing home then.
No, he's not in the nursing home.
He is in the opening. I can see his cartoon version.
Did they add that for episode 12 or was that there for the pilot?
No, because as Neil pointed out, the pilot didn't air until the end. So
yes,
they already had the credits
right.
and stuff.
Yeah. Right.
It's a real Firefly. You know, the pilot is the last episode out of the gate.
I will say,
where was Twitter for this show when it got canceled? No, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, right.
No, you're right. I will say, food for thought. Like, there is something to be said about, you know, if you were to make a sitcom specifically aimed at an over 65 audience, that's not a thing that really happens much, if at all. And
no.
Like, it is true that there's very little new content explicitly produced for an older age demographic audience. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be that things were always made for just like teens and people in their 20s and 30s. Now there is some stuff that's made much more.
What do you call NCIS, bud?
Yeah. Well, now there's a lot of stuff that's made specifically for, you know, people who are more middle-aged. Yeah, NCIS.
It's like Grace and Frankie.
Yeah. I'm not even so much talking about who it appeals to, but like for a character, for a person to see themselves on screen, like for an older 65 audience to not just, you know, to, mm-hmm. like the NCIS joke, to not just want to watch something, but like to see themselves represented on screen. There would be something to a show that is about those, you know, a buddy comedy with the two older guys and their trials and tribulations in a sitcom format, you know. So through that lens, this show deserves a second look. Like, this show didn't succeed, but it kind of demonstrates where characters like that could be built.
Golden Girls.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
that came later.
Golden Girls is a rare exception.
Golden Girls is just universally loved. So
true, right? I think it shows what Aaron's talking about, and that like it's a rare thing of. And I think that's what was really getting me on this one was I was just, at the end I was like, I've never seen this on TV. You know, I've never seen this age group portrayed. Mm-hmm. And like you were saying, like, it is really interesting that by the end of the show, Nathan Lane and Dana Carvey are taking a back seat, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. The only shows I can think of modern wise, at least in the last 5 years, are like, let's see, the Kominsky Method. There's that Be Positive show. And as Bryn mentioned, Grace and Frankie, that's like really it. And even mm-hmm. those, I feel like the writing staff is mostly young people, and they're trying to appeal to young people while simultaneously appeasing the older audience too. But as Aaron said, there's not really a show that's just like just for the older generation with older generation jokes that isn't trying to appeal to a younger audience, which is fascinating.
Yeah, where they just mm-hmm. cut the younger audience loose and say, we don't need this to appeal to anyone under 60. This is just for this audience.
Yeah,
that'd be interesting to see.
And it sounds like I'm being a jerk, but I mean, I'm really surprised CBS hasn't kind of explored that, being that a lot of their demographic does skew on the older side. But
those are the people still watching network television.
Those are the people watching Big Bang, who were watching Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. Get them.
Bryn, how would you like to connect one of the boys to friends in 6 degrees or less?
Yeah, sure. Let's get into it. I would say one of the boys and friends are connected by several 2-degree connections. So Barney Martin guest starred on the epic 2-parter episode of One of the Boys. As we've already referenced, he played Morty Seinfeld, Jerry's father on Seinfeld, for many episodes, including the one called The Wife, where Courtney Cox played Jerry's fake wife. And Courtney Cox is, of course, Monica Geller on Friends. Also,
surprised you didn't drop a Monica Geller Bing in there. Like, you're always so specific with the names.
We also mentioned already that Olympia Dukakis guest starred on One of the Boys. She also co-starred in the rom-com Picture Perfect with Jennifer Aniston. And then, of course, Jennifer Aniston was Rachel Green on Friends. We also, of course, mentioned the iconic Meg Ryan being featured in One of the Boys. She was a recurring character. She also co-starred with Lisa Kudrow on both the film Hanging Up and the series Web Therapy. And Lisa Kudrow played, who did she play, guys?
I don't know. You'll have to remind us.
Phoebe Buffay on Friends. And then we also have a connection between the creators of One of the Boys. So the creators, Bernie Orenstein and Saul Turtle Taub, were also writers on That Girl, which starred Marlo Thomas. And Marlo Thomas was a recurring character on Friends. She played Rachel Green's mother, Sandra.
Right on. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to say Bernie Orenstein is originally from Toronto. So that's exciting for us.
Hey, I nice connection.
Yeah.
Woo.
We could easily cut this out, but there's no way Wendy Malick wasn't on Friends, right?
She wasn't. And that's what I know. You know, like there's a lot of things that I feel like are kind of a Mandela effect where there's.
But she was on Seinfeld.
She was on Seinfeld.
She was on Seinfeld.
Obviously.
Yes.
But like, and I have to say, there probably are more connections. It's just that I didn't want to go that far. Like,
No. I don't care. It's just Wendy Malick. Connections.
But yeah, like it is weird that she was not on Friends because she was on every other NBC sitcom of the era as a guest star.
Love Wendy Malick.
But yeah, she was never on Friends. I also thought Meg Ryan had been on Friends. So that's like, I was like annoyed because I was like, oh, I swear she was one of the A-listers that like randomly popped up in Friends, but she wasn't. So
Meg Ryan hit a weird period in the late 90s where she stopped getting work for a while. And maybe, I don't know. It just coincided with Friends.
Yeah.
And I think Wendy Malick on Seinfeld's name was Wendy because she was the one Jerry kissed on the cheek and then he had to kiss everyone on the cheek. So it didn't seem like he was playing favorites.
She had the retro hairstyle too.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Yeah. She had like the beehive or whatever it was.
I don't know why Wendy Malick for me, I always just remember in just the Emperor's New Groove. She's got the voice of the villain in that. Oh, love it. Sorry, everyone.
And that's now it's time for the spinoff.
Yeah, so, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that, like, almost everyone in the cast were either, you know, already well-established and then continued to do great things, and then the newer young stars on the show went on to do big things, but I guess I'll kind of, like, give the greatest hits of everybody involved. So, Dana Carvey... Following one of the boys, he was cast in a 1-hour drama called Blue Thunder. So it's like a procedural drama about a police helicopter crew, which seemed like an odd thing. Like maybe he was like the comedic relief of the cast. But then soon after that show kind of had its brief run. He joined the cast of SNL in 1986, where he played like his most like iconic characters, including the church lady and Garth Algar. And this, of course, led to his huge comedy career in the 90s. So some of our favorites of the era are, of course, the Wayne's World movies. And, you know, he had his own short-lived sketch show called The Dana Carvey Show. And, you know, after he kind of cooled off a bit in at the end of the 90s, he still kind of pops up in things here and there. And I'm always thrilled to see him. He does a funny Joe Biden impression. Then we have Nathan Lane. After One of the Boys, he found a lot of success in the couple of years there in the early 80s on Broadway and off-Broadway. He came back to TV with a recurring role on another sitcom called The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. He made other appearances on TV and films in the early 90s. He is very well known for our generation as the voice of Timon on all the Lion King movies. He of course was in The Birdcage, Mouse Hunt. He also guest starred on Mad About You, but I didn't want to bring that up because you guys always get mad at me when I bring up Mad About You. More recently, he's had recurring roles on The Good Wife. He was on the season of American Crime Story about the O.J. Simpson trial. I thought he was quite good as F. Lee Bailey on there. He also had a fun recurring role as Pepper Saltzman on Modern Family, and he's currently on Only Murders in the Building, which I still haven't checked out, but I'm willing to.
One of my favorites.
It would be my favorite, but I just haven't watched it yet. And then we have Benjamin Sherman Crothers, also known as Scatman Crothers. He, you know, was already a legend in film and television. But he made several TV appearances following One of the Boys and joined the ensembles of two dramatic series. One was a Casablanca prequel, which is interesting.
Did he play Sam?
No, he played... what was his role? Whatever. Look it up. Anyway, That seems like an odd thing that they tried to do, but it was short-lived. And then he was in another drama series called Morning Star, Evening Star. He did a lot of voice acting in cartoons, including Transformers, which we all watched as kids, I'm sure. And he was quite busy on TV right up until his untimely death in 1986 from lung cancer. So he was like, you know, a legend right up until the end. And then Mickey Rooney, of course, you know, we all know the history of Mickey Rooney. It seems like he could never quite match his like A-list fame and success of his earlier career, but he never stopped hustling and working. Like he, you know, after One of the Boys bombed, he still kept appearing wherever he possibly could.
Just like on The Simpsons.
Well, yeah, exactly.
I was just about to say he could. Didn't he play the little girl in a Jell-O pudding commercial?
Yeah, like that is like the hilarious joke that is made in that iconic episode of
The
Simpsons from 1995, the Radioactive Man episode. He plays himself. Where the joke is that he will literally do anything and everything, even if it's an inappropriate role for him. And I swear to God, the entire time we were watching and like, you know, we're prepping for this episode, all I could hear in my head was Jiminy Jellicers, Jiminy Jellicers.
Like, Mickey Rooney.
Yeah.
It's true, though. When you see him in this show, you totally believe that this is someone who would not turn down a role. And would
literally
come out,
yeah.
I will say to his credit, will probably come out with enthusiasm for anything. Like,
yeah.
He seemed like every minute he was just ready to be like, what can I do in this scene? How can I Rooney this up?
For a straight hour and a half, I've just been like, don't mention Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Oh,
don't
God.
Mention,
yeah. That's a dark
Ooh,
one.
There are roles that one should not take.
Yeah. And that's the prime example. I wish I had researched was whether he became like a spokesperson later in life, because I think that's all the move of a lot of these like stars of that era. Like, did he do like a Wilford Brimley? Like, was he a spokesperson for something? I don't know. Yeah, he also appeared as the mayor in the 2011 Muppet movie with Jason Segel and Amy Adams. Made me really want to rewatch that because that's just such a delightful movie. So he passed away in 2014, but there are projects that he completed that like were released after. So it's so funny. His credits go all the way to 2020. Meg Ryan, who had a very small role in this sitcom. But it is, we have to mention her, of course. She had recurring TV roles soon after, this little blip, on One of the Boys. She had a recurring role on As the World Turns and Charles in Charge, which was pretty funny to see on her list of credits, and another show called The Wild Side. But after a supporting role in Top Gun, she kind of became a full-on movie star. She nabbed a few other smaller roles in films, and then, you know, by the time When Harry Met Sally came out, she was pretty much certified as America's sweetheart.
She Goose's wife in that?
That is correct. She's,
yes,
Goose's wife. Yeah.
Yes. Man, been a while.
And that's all I got.
And speaking of Scatman, just to hop on there for you, he did play Sam in Casablanca.
I was like, he must have.
And I looked at the cast. It was only 5 episodes. That's all it lasted. And Hector Elizondo was Captain Louis Renault, and Ray Liotta played a character named Sasha.
Yeah.
So pretty crazy.
Yeah. Oof. I kind of want to, like, I'm so tempted to look into that show. It is not a sitcom, so it's not a TWAS candidate, but, you know, it is like a very odd thing that they tried to do.
By the way, I just did a little quick research here, and I don't know if Mickey Rooney was a consistent spokesperson for any one company.
Okay.
But in his later years, did a hell of a lot of TV commercials in general. Right up until this one, when he was 84 years old, in a banned Super Bowl commercial, where it takes place in a sauna and he coughs and his towel falls off and it reveals his butt.
Oh, wow.
And that was the Super Bowl that involved the now infamous Janet Jackson controversy.
Wow. Just a lot of nudity.
It's a Justin
that night.
Timberlake controversy,
yes.
Really. But.
Yes, but
yeah.
Just speaking of how they reference it in the article here. But yes, it seems like he appeared in lots of commercials for all sorts of different brands, many of which you can find online, everything from mattress commercials to Dr. Pepper.
I remember.
Voice really cracked there.
Well,
Dr.
Thank
Pepper.
You, thank you, Aaron and Neil, for filling in the gaps of my research.
I remember that. I remember that Dr. Pepper commercial.
Oh, boy.
Should we give Mr. Producer a call and see what he has to say about this?
I guess so.
I'm excited to hear from Mr. Producer because he knows everyone and he has so many stories that he should have his own podcast, possibly. So,
God, don't encourage that asshole. As far as I can tell, that man just likes to hear himself talk. Hey, my little twuzzies, how's it going this week?
Hey, Mr. Producer, how are you doing today?
Aaron, my boy, I'm feeling just dandy.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Do you think you're ready to talk about an old show?
Am I ready? Aaron, do you see a pond around here?
No, we're on the phone, but no.
Do you have an intense craving for crackers and bread?
Sometimes.
That's your image being co-opted by a winter wear conglomerate.
No.
Think, why are you acting like such a silly goose? Of course I'm ready.
Well, great. Well, this week, we're talking about One of the Boys.
Oh, what a great project. I was involved, but only as a fan and as a friend of the production.
A friend of the production?
me and Mickey Rooney, we were great friends, I tell ya. Why, on the night he learned the pilot had been greenlit, he called me up and... Hi folks, Andrew Helmer here. I play Barry on That Was a Show. At this point, I would just like to point out that upon reaching out to the estate of Mr. Mickey Rooney, every element of this story was emphatically denied. Let's check back in. So Jerry Mathers is trying to keep both hands on the wheel, Barbara Stanwyck is in the back of the car, and she shouts... Hi folks, Barry here. I play Andrew Helmer in real life. Another small note, both the estates of Mr. Mathers and the great Mrs. Stanwyck also got in touch with us here at That Was a Show, and again, another flat-out denial. Thank you for your time. Let's cut back. And so Mickey cries out, the monkey can come, but I ain't paying for his ticket.
Wow, that was quite a story.
Oh boy, don't I know it.
And that all happened?
Every single word of it was the absolute truth. Allegedly. Well, kid, another one for the books.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Producer. I really appreciate you sharing that one.
A genuine pleasure, as always.
So he was friends with Mickey Rooney. That tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can see them getting into a whole lot of shenanigans together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of
yeah,
weird. Yeah. Kind of weird to hear him talk about the monkey in that regard, though.
I feel like he might have given Mickey Rooney the idea to hide all that money in his pants. Maybe that's a Mr. Producer trick that he taught him on set.
It certainly sounds right.
Yeah, or it could have been something that Mickey Rooney just observed as a trait. Like maybe he saw Mr. Producer just pulling wads of cash out of his pants and thinking like, that's the ticket. Does anyone have any leftovers?
I just want to say that, you know, it really did seem like, even though these are sitcoms, like the 80s really did like a two-parter. Like they really, like this is not the first time we've seen it now. And I think there's something there. I think we should like explore this further and maybe like a spin-off podcast or something.
I have noticed, and maybe it's just an Aaron thing, but I have noticed that anytime we find a two-parter, we try to watch it.
Yeah,
and I think it's always just like,
we can't
resist. I just think of like the audacity these terrible shows have to think that they can spread a story over two episodes in their first season.
Well, it's a Hail Mary, right? Like they probably knew they were going down. And it's just like, it's your move. It's the same thing. Like the Dregs of Humanity episode of It's Your Move. It's like, you know, they know it's okay. We got to do something big. We got to like,
but that might be why,
pull out all the stops.
That might be why actually that I'm always attracted to watching the two-parter was because with the Dregs of Humanity and It's Your Move, that was what sort of
it's just
saved that
yeah.
experience of talking about that show was that episode.
That episode. It's just so transparently desperate that it's like...
but like big swings.
Yeah.
Those ones have the biggest swings.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's the musicians on the Titanic, right? They got to keep playing even though the ship's going down. I had two things. One, I read a cool little tidbit here. Dana Carvey said in his book, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, that one of the boys was shot on the 6th floor of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, and to clear his head, he would often go up to the 8th floor to watch Eddie Murphy rehearsing for Saturday Night Live, so sort of manifesting his own role there, which is pretty cool.
That is cool.
That is very cool.
Very cool.
And then the only other thing was just a question. I noticed with this pilot or this show, and it's in some of the shows that you've reviewed before, but it's one of those sitcoms where there isn't really a dramatic, I don't know, like moral storyline or like, you know, a story of the week that they want to get across. It's just sort of, here are the jokes. That's it. Very, very thin plot. So I'm curious, do you think, was there a certain shift that you noticed in the 80s going to the 90s where, like, you know, once you get to Full House, I mean, every episode was a story of the week with like a moral or some sort of lesson. But this show is just straight like, we're just going to have Mickey Rooney and Scatman Crothers. They're going to make jokes. No real plot or anything like that.
We see them bounce back and forth a lot. Like we, especially in the 80s where the you know, the medium is really changing and changing back a lot. Like sometimes it works, you know, you got your MASH has a lot of drama in it. And then they're like, oh, I don't know. And then, you know, we watched After MASH, which barely had any comedy in it. And like, but not even in a joking way. Like that was that show was barely, it was mostly a drama. It was a 22 minute drama, which was weird.
Right.
So yeah, it's weird to see them go back and forth.
It'd be hard to pinpoint a particular turning point, but it does feel like once you get into the mid 90s, sitcoms get stratified into these particular categories. Like you have your family shows, you have your like 30 something hangout show, you have your workplace show. And maybe it was partly that sort of decision of targeting those particular lanes that enabled shows that were not in the family friendly category that kids can watch too. That like, okay, as long as we're not choosing to be in that particular bucket, then we have free rein to just make it funny and not worry too much about that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, doing the story of the week and the harder formula is like, it's just easier. It's just easier for everybody involved. Like, I think, you know, in the 80s, it seems like the lines were blurred and there was like, you know, they did whatever they wanted. Maybe it's because there was more cocaine flowing around, but like, I don't know. I think it's just like a way to like make it easier for everyone and just like, okay, like I said, it's like Mad Libs, like writing a, coming up with a sitcom concept and a, or a storyline. And it's just, you know, it's like how you get it done quickly and fast. And
I think you also have a
quickly
thing
quickly and
of,
fast are the same thing, but you know.
I think you also have a thing where in a lot of these cases, the sitcom, these aren't screenwriters, they're comedy writers.
Yeah.
So their bread and butter is I'm just going to come up with jokes. And then they have to figure out something to hang the coat on.
Yeah.
Right? That's pretty much it, right? It's a weird, whereas now, you know, you might hire a stand up in the room, but the most people in the writer's room are going to come from a screenwriting background.
Well, I feel like too, nowadays, I mean, from what I've experienced as well is from meetings I've taken or whatever, like everyone is expected to be, you have to be a good joke writer. You have to be a good dramatic writer. You have to, you know, have stage experience, podcast experience, comedy, drama. And everyone has to be such a jack of all trades so that they can get hired on a 60-minute show or a half an hour show, that it's just so hard to get work because everyone's looking for someone who does 10 things when you really want, you know, the like you just said, Barry, like we want one stand-up in the room who's really great at just crafting jokes and one person who's great at plot. But you just have to be so good at everything now. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I would love to talk a little bit more about some of your work, Neil. Why don't you start by telling our audience a little bit about your podcast, seeing as how we've already teased the fact that Bryn and I appeared as guests, and thank you again for having us. Talk a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, so I'm one of the co-hosts of Triviality. It's a weekly pub trivia style game show podcast. We have guests from all around the world come on, and they'll host games. There'll be contestants, and it's basically a 60-minute trivia game. You get about 30, 35 questions a week. We do bonus episodes on specific categories. So you might have, you know, an episode on Seinfeld or a certain sport, NFL, something like that. So we do those once a month on top of our weekly episodes. And we just or soon are going to be celebrating our 5-year anniversary.
Woohoo! Congrats.
Thank you. Which is really great. And it's crazy that we've gotten this far. But yeah, if you like pub trivia, if you ever go to the bar and you play along with a host who comes to bring a game, you know, come give us a listen. We're on all your favorite podcast apps, and you can, you know, have your beer at home. And if you want to start with one, even though it's a harder game, I think we might have said harder than it should be, but episode 233, The Fall of the House of Escher, is the one that Aaron and Bryn guested on. And we're gonna have to have you back though, because it has to be more pop culture focused, which is also my specialty. So I think it'll be a lot more fun.
Well, we're always up for it. Now tell us about your book. We're very excited to hear more about that.
Yeah, so the book is my comedic love letter to Patrick Swayze. As you said, it's called Being Patrick Swayze, Essential Teachings from the Master of the Mullet. And it's basically a collection of essays, games, quizzes, trivia, all about Patrick Swayze and his life and career. I wrote it over the pandemic, like during the beginning of lockdown, so it kept me sane, which was great. And it's just a really just like a nice gift book, like something you'd want to get someone who's a movie fan or a fan of Swayze specifically. I'm just a pop culture fanatic, so it's just a great way to sort of explore someone's career and just make it fun for not only people who love Swayze or who love movies from the 80s or things from the 80s like we do here, but for a newer audience who maybe doesn't know a lot about Swayze, but then they can play a game like match the mullet to the movie or which Swayze character you would go on a date with, that kind of thing. So a lot of fun stuff on top of it.
Answer is all of them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. It has to be all of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Who doesn't love Swayze?
It is. I haven't found anyone who doesn't like Swayze so far. So hopefully, hopefully I won't find anyone during the process of this. But yeah, the book's going to be available everywhere you get your books. For listeners in Canada, it's going to be at Indigo. It's going to be, in Australia, UK, at all the indie bookstores, or you can go to your big stores like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, or if you want to support independent bookstores, you can go to bookshop.org, which the money there benefits independent bookstores, which is really nice. So I try to go to independent bookstores and I get books just to help out, no matter how big or small they are. And if you'd like to pre-order it, you can find it at any of those places, or you can go to my website, neilefisher.com/books, and you can find some of those links there and a little bit more information. And hopefully, you know, pick up the book, enjoy it. And if you want, reach out. I'll talk to you about Patrick Swayze or sign your book, or you can just yell at me that it wasn't good enough or something, like, and I'll just deal with it. So.
I'm looking forward to reading that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds incredible.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
And is there anything else that you would like to plug or talk about that you've been working on?
No, not necessarily. Just the podcast. If you want to check it out, have some fun. I'm trying to work on some other book projects. My main, bread and butter work is directing commercials and writing and making films of different kind. It's been a little bit hard during the pandemic, but I mentioned before, I loved Unlicensed that Aaron and Bryn worked on. It's just a great short film that I watched on CBC Gem with a VPN. So it was nice to get around the system and see some other great artists. So the only thing I would say is, you know, being an artist of some kind, I hate calling myself an artist, but I suppose I am, because we make all of us make art. But if you know anyone who's in the creative field, the only thing I'll say is just let them know that you've seen their work. Give them a compliment. It goes a long way, because it takes a lot of hard work to create something, whether it's a podcast, a picture, a piece of art, a film, anything like that. And often we're in our own heads making the art that we never open ourselves up to receive any sort of compliments. So it'll go a long way. So compliment someone on their artwork if you can.
100% agree.
What you just said is so true. And I really appreciate that sentiment.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
And on that note, we don't do it a lot, but please, you know, leave us a review anywhere you can on your podcast apps or anything. Like, just, you know, we want to hear from you. So.
Well,
I agree with what Neil said. It makes your day when you hear anything like that.
Yeah. The amazing thing about having a podcast is that it does open the door to interact with all the listeners out there. And we just love hearing from people. So you know, reach out to us on Instagram or email us, you know, at that was a show or that was a show at AOL.com. We always want to hear from you.
Yeah. I should also plug again, because I think I've only mentioned this once so far, that we have a new website, thatwasashow.com.
We failed to mention that
before. Yeah, the exact web address that you would expect, thatwasashow.com. And that has links to not only listen to the show on various platforms, but also a contact form and some information about our sponsor and merchandise and lovely things like that. So one last thing, Neil, is that as you are probably aware from listening to our podcast, we've been gradually building a library of tropes. So I'll just throw it to you. Are there any tropes that you would like to point out, even if they're not specifically related to one of the boys, just about sitcoms in general, even, or anything else that you think is an interesting takeaway from the experience of watching this show and the deep analysis that we've now done?
That's a really great question. Yeah, let me just think of that for one second.
As a connoisseur of popular culture yourself.
I know. I was trying to think of stuff too before we started recording, and I wonder which way I should take it. I think as far as tropes are concerned, this show does use a lot of tropes that we've seen many times before. I think Brent even mentioned it. There is an often used trope of female characters kind of just being eye candy and being kind of thrown away for the butt of the joke for the male characters. I mean, I guess that's Two and a Half Men's entire filmography there. But that one I see a lot. But the one thing actually I noticed, it was funny, I was watching this and it was a response that I wasn't planning on having. But seeing Mickey Rooney and Scatman Crothers and even Mrs. Green sort of interact with these young college kids, it sort of made me think about all the time I enjoy asking my grandfather or grandmother about just different things. Like, what was it like in, 1962 when you had to go to a baseball game? Like, what was it? Public transportation? Were you buying a hot dog? How much was it? And even though, the elderly sometimes can be a little rambunctious and drone on with long stories, it is kind of fun to, pay respect and talk to our elders. And it just made me think of, I should do it a little bit more, maybe not have one of them move in with me. just talk to our elders a little bit more, learn a little bit, maybe about some of the mistakes we've made, some of the things that they learned that we can learn. And also just my favorite thing is showing them things from this era to see how disgusted they are compared to what they used to watch. So that's my takeaway.
That's fun. Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note, thank you again for joining us, Neil.
Thanks so much. It was an absolute pleasure having you on with us.
Oh, likewise. It was so fun to be here. It's even better than listening at home. And I just wish you guys the greatest success because I love the show. And I just think production quality, everything about it is top notch. And I'll be listening every week. So
thank you so much.
Thank you, kind sir.
It was a pleasure. And we look forward to speaking with you again. And cut to credits. That Was a Show is created and hosted by Bryn Burney, Andrew Barry Helmer, and myself, Aaron Yeager. It's a production of Radio Gizmo in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe, rate, review, and share. Follow us on Instagram and tell your friends about it. That Was a Show.
Radio Gizmo.